Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Former Senator George McGovern knows what it's like to lose. He lost 49 states to Richard Nixon in the presidential race of 1972. But despite that experience, his advice to today's politicians is it's better to lose an election than to lose your soul. Joining me from South Dakota Public Broadcasting Studio in Vermilion, former U.S. Senator George McGovern. Good morning to you, sir, and welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I wish we were on television so people could see how terrific you look.
You
look about 10 years younger than the last time I was on your program.
Well, isn't that nice of you to say? Thank you very much. Sure. Just trying to stay in good health and good shape. Tell me, Senator McGovern, what compelled you to write this open letter to President Obama now?
Well, it was the fact that I watched that what seemed to me almost senseless debate over the national debt and the deficits, and the fact that people were so negative all the way through. And that not a single senator that I heard, I'm sure there were some that I didn't hear, but not one that I listened to said anything about the cause of this national debt. It's certainly not the school lunch program or the programs to help the schools. It's the wars we've been in. That war in Iraq cost $3 trillion, according to our Nobel Prize-winning economist, Joseph Stiglitz. And the one in Afghanistan will be about the same. And the biggest part of the federal government is the military department. It's $700 billion a year. So I wanted to write an article to say, now, wait a minute. Let's look at what is causing these national debts, and let's get at the root of the problem. It's the fact that we're exaggerating the need for these huge military operations, and that's the point I was trying to make.
Now, I understand that Lawrence Korb, who was at one time Assistant Secretary of Defense, has come up with a new plan to reduce Defense Department spending. But you go all the way back to World War II, Senator, where you fully participated. You talked about the fact that the War Department name was actually changed to the Defense Department. I was interested in your comments on that.
Well, you know, public relations is a fine art. I wish I had been better at it. But the Defense Department for a century was called the War Department. But in 1947, some smart PR person said, call yourself the Defense Department, not the War Department. Nobody thinks happy thoughts about war, but everybody would be in favor of defense. And I think that's true. It's been almost regarded as sacred when the Congress examines the military budget, or what is called the Defense Department. I think there are lots of things that contribute to our national defense. One is health, the health of our people. Another is the education of our young people. Another is protecting our environment. Still another, finding safer and cleaner fuels to provide our energy. So I don't want to see it go unnoticed that we're still spending $700 billion a year on the military. And I think that's too much.
And you also, I gather, feel that defense lobbyists have had a great deal to do with that.
Yes, they have, but so have the members of Congress. We lobby for a defense base in our state, whether it's Oklahoma or Idaho or Texas or wherever. Most members of Congress want a military base in their states because it means jobs. And so we've got to think, if we're going to reduce that process somewhat, we've got to think of alternative ways of putting people to work other than simply sending them into the military.
I'm interested, Senator McGovern, that you parallel the problems that President Obama faces today with those that President Roosevelt faced during the Great Depression. Do you really believe that things are that bad?
I don't think so. I don't think that the recession is as acute as the Great Depression was. But it's a similar problem in that we've got to get our people back to work. I don't think President Obama, who I support as our president and who I supported as a candidate, has spent too much money trying to take us out of this recession. I don't think we've invested enough in that process. Now, President Roosevelt didn't make that mistake. He set up the Public Works Administration to put up new public buildings all over the country. We've got a beautiful courthouse in Mitchell, South Dakota, my hometown, that was built in the New Deal. And we did get most of our people back to work by those programs that President Roosevelt offered. I'd like to see something similar today, including beginning to build the best, fastest, and safest railway system in the world. That's one way to put people back to work. It would save energy. It would protect the environment if it were properly constructed. And that's the kind of alternative things we ought to be looking to put our idle people back to work.
I gather you'd also like to see the Bush tax cuts lapse and then raise taxes on the rich even more.
Absolutely. You know, that's what the graduated income tax is all about. And that's been the heart of American progress for the last 50 years and more, that we did have a graduated tax, which means that people who have very high incomes should pay at a higher rate to the federal government. It's argued by the advocates of giving the rich tax cuts that they will spend that employing people. It doesn't work that way. They invested in the stock market. They may invest it in a yacht. They may take a longer vacation in Europe. But there's no real evidence that tax cuts for the 1% of our people who are the richest is going to lead to more employment. It just doesn't work that way.
You know, it has been, as you suggested earlier, sad to watch this impasse between the White House and the Congress over raising the debt ceiling. But, you know, President Obama seemed to be backed against the wall. He wasn't able to do what President Roosevelt accomplished. And the question is, why? Was he not strong enough? Was he not firm enough? Did he not stand strong enough in his own positions?
Well, I think President Obama is a strong person. I think he's a good leader. I think he's an excellent spokesman. He's about the best campaigner I've ever witnessed. But what has happened to our politics, I find very disturbing. We're more hard-boiled with each other. We're more antagonistic with each other. There's a strange lack of civility in the Congress that I didn't find in all those years that I served, first in the House and then in the Senate.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know all of the reasons for it, but what I would like to see, I'd like to have people recognize that our political opponents are not our enemies. We're all Americans. No party has a monopoly on virtue or on the truth, although I am biased enough to think the Democrats have a little more of those good virtues than the other side. And I do think the Republicans who have a minority in the Senate have tried to act as though they have a majority and to run over the president's program, to run over their opponents in the Congress. What is really needed is more civility. The Bible has a more lofty way. It says we should love one another. I agree with that.
All right, and we'll take just a short break here. Former U.S. Senator George McGovern is on the line with me. Stay with us. Welcome back. Former U.S. Senator George McGovern recently wrote a letter to President Obama, which appears in Harper's Magazine. He talks about what he would like to see President Obama move forward on, despite the kind of resistance he is receiving within the Congress. And you are invited to join our conversation, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Senator McGovern, there are an awful lot of people who might say at this point, well, Senator McGovern has these views, they're wonderful liberal views, but nobody is going to pay attention. It is the conservatives who are in control, and that's all there is to it.
Well, I disagree with that. I have always thought that we need both a good, strong conservative political party in the United States and a good, strong liberal party. My mother and father lived and died as conservative Republicans. Whether they would have voted for me when I ran for president, if they had lived that long, I don't know. But it would have been something of a stretch. But they didn't go in for the kind of knock-down, kick-em, blast-em politics that we've seen too much of in recent years. Let me, if I may, give you a couple of personal examples of the kind of thing I would like to see.
Surely.
When I took on the Vietnam War as a major issue in the 1960s and the 1970s, I introduced an amendment to terminate that war within a set period of time, and I got Senator Mark Hatfield of Oregon, who recently died, a wonderful man, and he and I teamed up. It became known as the McGovern-Hatfield Amendment to end the war. I suppose in Oregon it was known as the Hatfield McGovern War, but we never had any trouble over whose name came first.
Right.
We got at one time up to 43 votes for that amendment, and right after my campaign, the Congress took up a similar proposal and ended the war. Now, I can give you another example. When I was running for president in 1972, Bob Dole, the senator from Kansas, was the Republican national chairman, and it was his job to take a bite out of me almost every morning before breakfast and maybe another one before he went to bed at night. But after that campaign was out of the way, he and I teamed up on anything that had to do with agriculture or with feeding hungry kids in the school lunch program or the WIC program for low-income pregnant and nursing women and their infants. And we got along just fine. Today, as I am on your program, Bob Dole is one of the best friends I have in the country. And we both found that the other one didn't have horns. When we got in close, we loved our wives, we loved our children, we loved this country. We were both combat veterans in World War II. I, a bomber pilot, and he, a mountain member of the Mountain Division. So we need to recognize our common humanity.
But one of the points you make in this letter is that you believe many in Congress have lost, quote, love of nation. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's this new type of politics where you hire the cleverest political advisors, professionals, you know, people that know how to use television and radio and the press and billboards and all the rest. They also know something about the human psyche, some of these people that I think use that skill for things that aren't entirely lofty. Their appeal is based on fear. It's based on suspicion. It's based on trying to look for weak points in the other person's makeup, in their character, in their backgrounds, and to cut that person up rather than to deal with the big issues. I don't say it's easy to maintain a high level of discourse. Diane, you always do that in your programs. I'm not trying to butter you up, but one of the things people love about you is that you treat them with respect. You go after ideas. You bring on people with differing ideas, sometimes very different from yours. But I think that's what is needed in American politics.
It's interesting to read in former Vice President Dick Cheney's book, his new autobiography, where he says that President George W. Bush's decision to go to war in Iraq was truly courageous. Do you think that that's how history is going to see it?
I think it was truly courageous and even more truly wrong. We never should have invaded Iraq. They had absolutely nothing to do with the 9/11 attack in New York and at the Pentagon. And we knew that. When I say we, our informed people in Washington, in the administration, knew that Iraq. Now, they had a miserable leader in Saddam Hussein, but he had nothing to do with al-Qaeda or Osama bin Laden. In fact, they detested each other. Osama bin Laden was a fanatical believer in religious ideas. The leader of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, was an atheist. So they had nothing in common. I think he might have been on the target list of Osama bin Laden. But we had no business invading Iraq, and we ought to terminate that as fast as we can.
And what about President Obama's involvement in Libya? Dick Cheney says in his book he advocated bombing Syria. Is America's appetite for intervention going too far?
Well, I think it has been. I think that's what Vietnam was all about. Vietnam was no threat to us. As soon as we got our troops out of their country, they became our friends. You can go there and have a nice vacation today. They don't hate Americans. And I think the same thing was true in the case of Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, with Libya, this is a miserable government there. They've persecuted people. They've tortured people. And we've done a wise thing. We've gotten NATO involved, so it's not just an American operation. That's a big difference.
But, of course, you fought, as you said, in World War II. You were a willing soldier. When did you begin to get misgivings about America's involvement in foreign conflicts?
The first time on a major scale was Vietnam. I was dead set against that, and I made that the major issue of my presidential campaign. That's how I won the nomination, was my opposition to the Vietnam War. The problem with it politically is that I suppose about a third of the Democrats favored the Vietnam War, and probably two-thirds or more of the Republicans favored it. So running against that war was difficult in the general election, and the result was President Nixon's big landslide win. But Vietnam was what set me off in questioning the so-called wise men.
We have many callers who'd like to pose a question to you. Senator, I'm going to open the phones now and go first to O'Fallon, Missouri. Good morning, Jerry.
Senator McGovern, all I can say is everything you're saying is completely sane and sensible, and I still don't know why that never gets any traction. I mean, here in Missouri, I would put a quotation marks around Democratic Senator, whose name is Claire McCaskill, will jump right on the bandwagon every time that, you know, Boeing gets another big defense contract, because that means jobs. And as I've explained for years and years, you know, when I was back in McDonnell Douglas, we developed generations and generations of new fighter planes. About 2% of those were ever used in any kind of combat. And yes, it did put people to work. But as you said, had we taken that same amount of resources and put it towards a rail system in this country, I'd be able to step out of my front porch practically and go anywhere I wanted to. And obviously, you know, I'm preaching to the choir, or you are, and vice versa. But why does this argument not get any traction? I just don't understand.
Well, that's a perfectly good question. I wish I knew more about the human heart and about the human mind, because I do think that somehow it's easier to sell war than it is peace. It's either easier to sell marching off to kill than it is defeating hungry people. You may know that a passion of my life for 50 years has been to feed hungry people, both in this country, where I teamed up with Bob Dole in order to do that. We doubled all the food assistance programs, and overseas. But, you know, this is not a new problem. You read in the Bible, I think it was the words of the man of Nazareth, that the way to destruction is broad. The way to salvation is narrow and difficult to pursue. So they were grappling with that 2,000 years ago. Why do people choose fear? Why do they choose hatred? Why is it so difficult? You know, I was watching a young mother the other day. I was out in Rapid City, more accurately at Mount Rushmore, and this young mother had three little children. She was saying to them, "Now don't fight. Stop hitting each other." And I stopped to think, you know, I wonder if we could get that young woman to talk to the heads of state.
That would be wonderful. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Senator George McGovern is my guest, and we will continue to take your calls. Senator, I'd like to ask you about your suggestion to expand Medicare to all Americans. Given the backlash that President Obama had experienced against his health reform, wouldn't that just be political suicide for him?
Well, I'll say this. If President Obama's opponents run against him next year on the grounds that they're against health care and he's for it, he's going to win. I think most Americans really favor universal health care, and they should, because other countries, other industrial countries, have been experimenting with it for 50 years. And I think that's what we should do. I think one of the reasons that my friend Hillary Clinton, and she is my friend and she's a great lady, doing a wonderful job as Secretary of State, she tried in the Clinton administration to sell comprehensive health care. Now, I think maybe she would agree with me that one problem they may have made, that the program was too complicated. It was too long. I think it was something like 1,500 pages. I never read a piece of legislation of 1,500 pages in my life, and I don't intend to start now. But anyway, what I'm proposing, you can say in one line, Congress hereby extends Medicare to all Americans. Period.
And how would you do that? You'd introduce that little by little.
Yeah, I would do it at two-year intervals, maybe to begin with the little kids, with the infants and children, say, up to the age of 8. Start with them for a couple of years. And then after the hospitals and the doctors and the nurses got over the shock, began with those, say, from 9 to 18, and then 19 to 35, and then on up to 65. It's not all that complicated. It's what every other industrial country already has.
Former Senator George McGovern. And after a short break, we'll come back, take your calls, read your email. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the federal government takes on the nation's biggest banks. Why the administration says banks failed to act responsibly while pursuing billions of dollars in compensation. And we're back. We'll go right back to the phones. Your questions, your comments for Senator George McGovern. He's on the line with us this morning for the entire hour. Let's go to Rochester, New York. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, sir.
I'm a long-time listener, and I love you. And Senator McGovern, I would love to be referring to you as former President McGovern. My question is, what do you think it's going to take to get these Tea Party people and these ultra-right don't want to spend a dime in the right places and just eviscerate all the public programs? What do you think it's going to take to make them see the light that that's not going to work, and that the only way to get this country moving again is with a federal jobs program? It's worked in every recession up till now. I don't know why they think that if we slash the budget and slash spending, all of a sudden a magic wand is going to make everything better. What's on this?
Well, this is, you're absolutely right. When you're in a recession or a depression, you don't cut federal spending, you increase it, because we've got to stimulate more activity in this economy. I mentioned President Roosevelt earlier in this broadcast. In those days, I was a Republican. I grew up that way with my mother and father. But gradually, I began to see what Roosevelt was doing. He was constantly blasted as the big spending liberal. Do you know what his budget was during the New Deal from 1933 to 1940?
What?
$7 billion a year. Now we have to count it in trillions.
Yes.
But we shouldn't cut our budget today when we're in a recession. What that does is put a damper on the program. And we shouldn't try to balance our budget in the middle of a recession. First of all, you can't do it. And secondly, it doesn't provide the kind of job stimulus that we need. We ought to be building public buildings, courthouses and schools and hospitals. We ought to be building roads. We ought to be building a railroad, the best in the world. We were the pioneers in railroads in the 19th century. We ought to become the pioneers again in the current century.
Now, here's an email from Tim in Dallas. He says, please ask the senator to comment on the seeming increase in religious rhetoric from far-right Republican presidential candidates. And let me just tell you that Republican presidential candidate Michelle Bachmann told Floridians on Sunday that Hurricane Irene and the earthquake felt along much of the East Coast last week were messages from God to warn politicians to start heeding divine guidance. I'm not sure what that means, but I wonder about your own thoughts.
Well, I know Congresswoman Bachmann insists that she's following the word of God at all times, that God told her to run for president, and he's guiding her in what she says. I think that's pretty risky ground to be on. You know, and then blaming this hurricane on God. 21 people were killed in that hurricane, and my heart goes out to all of those families. But I don't think that was God intervening to try to teach us a lesson. Let me tell you about a little story I experienced when I was 10 years old. I was watching two of my friends peg a baseball back and forth, and one ball went high, went out into the street with the person that it was intended for, hard after it, right into the path of an oncoming truck. He was killed instantly. And a few minutes later, the minister from our church came over, and he said to the mother, "Well, Mrs. So-and-so, I know this is a hard day for you, but this was God's will." She says, "No, Reverend, I don't think so. I think Roger just didn't look where he was going." Well, I agreed with the mother. I don't think it's right for us to blame these tragedies, whether they're natural tragedies, the results of scientific principles, or whatever, to blame all these calamities on God and say that's his way of punishing us. I wouldn't be interested in a God who deliberately kills people in order to give them a lesson. So I think, in all due respects to Mrs. Bachmann, who may be a very fine woman, I don't know her, I've never met her, but I don't think that she has a monopoly on the word of God.
All right, let's go to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Bennett.
Well, good morning, Senator. It's good to hear your voice. I qualify you as a good statesman, and although you lost, well, I think the cards were stacked against you. But we both lived through the Depression, I'm sure. And the causes of the depression, say in Germany of the 1920s, was that German capital and German banks was exited from, taken out of Germany because the German industry didn't want to pay English and French war debts or whatever they were called. Now here in the United
States, indemnity.
Indemnity, whatever. It was kind of a reparations of some sort, a punishment. Here in the United States in the 1990s and early 2000, American industry and American banks have been exporting capital and productive capabilities all over the world, to China, Indonesia, to Philippines, Japan. You name the place, and American industry has set cash in those places, taken out of the United States. And to me, we're following a parallel in the United States today of Germany of the 1920s for the same root causes, and I wish you'd comment on it.
Well, I think there's a considerable truth in what you say. I don't consider myself an expert on the international monetary situation. The late Senator Symington once told me, when I asked him as an industrialist, well, tell me about the international monetary system, he said, well, they say there are only two people that understand it, a Swiss banker and a clerk in a bank in Berlin, and they disagree. So I've given up on the international monetary situation. I do think this, though, that a lot of our troubles began right at the top of the industrial and financial circles in this country. They led us down a mistaken path, not intentionally. I don't think they're evil people, but I do think they were on the wrong track in granting mortgages. In fact, trying to market mortgages, market them, push them to people that couldn't afford
exactly
to take a mortgage.
Yeah.
And that's where we got into a lot of this trouble. But when it comes to these international monetary questions, I'm going to call up you and say, what do we do now?
Bennett, you just wait for a call. Thanks for calling. Let's go now to Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi there, Sam. Sam, are you there? I guess.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay,
sorry about that portable phone. I wanted to ask the senator, I actually worked on his campaign as an 18-year-old in 1972, and I was wondering if the senator thinks that electoral politics is still a viable way to govern the United States. And I ask that question because it seems that the government doesn't do what the people of the country want it to do. And if you just look at polls, I know when the single-payer system was up for consideration, every poll that I read, the majority of Americans were very interested in, you know, a Medicare system for all. But that's not what the government did. And similarly, people have wanted out of Afghanistan, I think the polls now for 3 or 4 years consistently. And it just seems like because there's so much money in electoral politics, and particularly in the House, it's just not viable anymore because every 2 years you vote for a new person. They do whatever they're going to do, and then you vote again, and nothing seems to move.
Well, I think you've got a good point there. Money is the biggest change in American politics since I began. My first campaign for Congress cost $12,000. The two congressional candidates running in that same district now spend a couple of million. And I don't think they're any smarter than I was, but they certainly have got a lot more money. But you're quite right. We've got to do something about big money in politics. I live part of the year in Florida, the rest of the time in my home state of South Dakota. But we elected a governor there in Florida who spent $72 million of his own money. Well, who's going to beat a guy with $72 million? And so I think you put your finger on a real problem in American politics. I'd like to see us go to the public financing of campaigns. The best way taxpayers can protect their interest in the government is to pay for it, to pay for the campaign that takes people there, because that will help free these individuals from the kind of pressures they're under now.
Well, it would also mean that people who are not millionaires or billionaires are elected to the Congress, perhaps with ideas other than lowering taxes on the very wealthy. I mean, aren't most of those in Congress now very wealthy people?
Most of them are pretty wealthy, as you say, very wealthy compared to the typical American. And that is a change from the time when I was there. Not that everything was virtuous in my day either, but it was better than the situation we have today.
Senator George McGovern of South Dakota, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to East Hampton, New York. Good morning, Arthur. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you. And I just wanted to call up and quickly thank the senator for his service to our country, not only in the Senate, but during his fine service during World War II. And I wanted to sort of ask him if he thought some of the partisanship that has emerged in our politics, I trace some of it myself, to the rancor that our country found ourselves in during that war in Vietnam. And I salute him for his stance against the war, and I supported him in 72. And I think we've seen the wisdom of his thoughts and his beliefs come to fruition in this country, and people finally realize that these foreign entanglements are not what they seem to be and do not benefit us. Again, thank you for his service, and I think one of the great ironies was that Senator McGovern was a true patriot, a true war hero, and his patriotism was questioned during his run for the presidency. I found that despicable. And thank you for your service, Senator.
Thank you for your kind words. I should just let people like you speak for me. You do a better job of selling me than I do myself. Let me say one thing about 72. We got beat badly by Richard Nixon, but when people say, was the whole thing a loss, I remind him that we won the nomination in a field of some of the most capable politicians we had, Hubert Humphrey, Ed Muskie, Scoop Jackson, various other, the mayor of New York, John Lindsay. There were 15 other candidates. So I remind people it wasn't all losses. We won 11 primaries, including the two biggest ones, New York, where you live, and California. You know, there was a coach of the Buffalo Bills that took his team to the Super Bowl four times in a row. He lost all four times. Someone said, "Coach, isn't it embarrassing to go to the Super Bowl four times and lose every time?" He says, "Yes, it's very painful. You want to know how you avoid that kind of pain? Just don't get to the Super Bowl."
Exactly.
We got to the Super Bowl in 72, and with a few breaks, it could have gone the other way, but
and
we got some bad breaks.
And what happened afterwards, Senator?
Well, there was a bipartisan investigation of Mr. Nixon by the Senate. A bipartisan one in the House. They both found him guilty of repeatedly violating the Constitution and federal law, and he was thrown out of office. I went to Mr. Nixon's funeral, as I did Mrs. Nixon's. I don't have any malice towards them, but the thought occurred to me, listening to all the eulogies to President Nixon, that even from his standpoint, he'd have been better off if I had won. I tried to tell the country that in that election, but they went overwhelmingly for Mr. Nixon, and I think it's too bad because we had a great army out there of McGovern supporters.
Indeed. Thank you so much for joining us, Senator, from South Dakota Public Broadcasting Studio there in Vermilion. I know how much our listeners have enjoyed hearing you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Diane. You're a wonderful voice in the media these days.
Thank you. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.